21.
You are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months.
Always for them, duty, honor, country.
Has maintained the closest surveillance of the Soviet military buildup on the island of Cuba.
The war in Vietnam.
We will not turn, we will not falter, and we will not fail.
Hello and welcome to the American Military History Podcast. My name is Justin, and I am the host of the podcast. Today's episode is episode 33, The Battle of Bennington. It's part 30 in our series on the Revolutionary War. Last week, we took a brief break in our stream of battle discussions when we talked about the flag resolution and some of the history around how the design of the first U.S. flag came about. But this week, it is once more unto the breach as we discuss the Battle of Bennington. But before we discuss that battle, we do need to touch on a few small things that happened after the Battle of Ridgefield, which occurred in the spring of 1777, which will lead us up to the Battle of Bennington. Now, the same summer, the summer of 1777, the British kicked off a campaign that was designed to isolate New England from the rest of the 13 colonies, which, if it went according to plan, it would serve to separate, isolate, and help crush the rebellion. Essentially, what they wanted to do is make the kind of fledgling Continental Army fight a war on two fronts, and that's difficult even with a seasoned and experienced army, let alone a for lack of a better term, not offensive in any way, a ragtag fledgling army. Now, we saw the start of this campaign when Benedict Arnold held them off at the Battle of Valcour Island, and that advance was hampered by the onset of winter, so they somewhat paused the campaign, and now that it's summer again, they're going to kick it off in full. So the snow has melted, and British General John Burgoyne has led his army down the Lake Champlain and Hudson River corridor, and he's moving towards Albany, New York, with apparent ease. He's capturing several forts along the way, and he even took Ticonderoga back on July 6th. Fort Ticonderoga was under the command of American General Arthur St. Clair, and St. Clair was forced to surrender the fort when his 3,000-man force was surrounded by the almost 8,000 men that Burgoyne commanded. And those men were actually on the high ground around the fort as well, so it was not a good scenario for St. Clair to be in. And there were a few shots that were fired back and forth, and yes, there were a couple of casualties on each side, and by couple, I mean small, like less than 10 on each side. The fort was handed over with no official siege, even though you hear this event referred to as the Siege of Fort Ticonderoga, and usually in parentheses you'll see 1777, because we already talked about the first siege earlier in the podcast when Benedict Arnold took it from the British. So there's a couple different sieges, but this one's not necessarily a siege in the sense that the army deployed and there was a big battle, et cetera, et cetera. It was a kind of a gracious handover from St. Clair to Burgoyne. And that kind of spurred up an interesting side story. Now, General Schuyler and St. Clair were both involved with the surrender of Ticonderoga. And the fact that they were so willing to give it over to the British without a fight, it made them villains in the eyes of the Continental Congress, and it actually caused an uproar with the American public and in certain military circles. And their court-martial trials would later clear them of any wrongdoing. Their careers were absolutely affected by the events here at Ticonderoga. Schuyler had already lost his command to Horatio Gates by the time the court-martial came around, and St. Clair would not hold any more field commands for the remainder of the war. By August of 1777, Major General John Burgoyne's army had forced its way south from Canada all the way down Lake Champlain and then to Fort Edward on the Hudson River. General Schuyler, and he's still in command as his court-martial hasn't happened yet, lay with the American army to the south of the Mohawk River Junction on the Hudson. And he was kind of covering the New York state capital of Albany. And he wanted, obviously, to keep the British from moving into Albany. Now, from a public setting in the area around Albany, where Shuler is actually set up, after the events at Ticonderoga, all of the rebels in the area are a little worried because they see Burgoyne advancing down. They're concerned, you know, they may be overrun. So they're not necessarily being the most, what's the right word? They're not being the most vocal patriots at this point. They're kind of, you know, suppressed a little bit. Or maybe subdued, maybe a better word. You know, recruitment's low. They're not doing a lot of anti-British demonstrations, et cetera, et cetera. Now, you would think, if you were a British commander, that this would be a promising situation for you. And in a way it is, but Burgoyne's circumstances were far from promising. His army had struggled through the heavy forested woods from Ticonderoga, and they had to actually build a road to carry the artillery and carts. So his men are exhausted. They've been working for a long time to build the roads and transport everything down there. And Shuler, as he had retreated to Albany, had actually played it smart, and he had wasted the countryside, which left Burgoyne short of supplies and proper transport. And the army, Burgoyne's army, had so few horses that the Brunswick Dragoons were still on foot. So for those of you that don't know, Dragoons are typically horse-mounted infantry. They're light cavalry. It's kind of hard to have light cavalry without a horse. So that's an interesting note there. Now, the difficulties of Burgoyne's march in the countryside proved yet another reminder of the problems of campaigning in the vast forests of North America. And it's actually interesting to note that pretty much every British general since Braddock in 1755 actually experienced in varying degrees what Burgoyne is experiencing now. Now, the final blow to Burgoyne was a letter from General Howe at New York. Howe informed Burgoyne that the main British army was leaving to invade Pennsylvania, rather than attacking up the Hudson to meet him, which is what this grand plan for Burgoyne's campaign actually entailed in the first place. One army would come from north to south, one army would move from south to north, and the two would meet in the middle. Burgoyne came to the conclusion that he's not going to get reinforced from the south like he had originally planned. He's going to have to find his supplies and his reinforcements in the area that he's in. So he grabs one of his colonels, a man by the name of Colonel Baum, B-A-U-M. Oh, and by the way, Burgoyne, I'm probably not pronouncing that right. It's spelled B-U-R-G-O-Y-N-E, for those of you that are wanting to look that up. So Burgoyne directs Baum to take a force into Manchester in Vermont, which is east of Fort Edward. And he tells Baum to go find horses for his dragoons and for the army's transport, to get any supplies of food that he can find, and to kind of do a show of force for any rebels that he would see in the area. Just let them know that the British are there, they shouldn't try anything, because if they do, the British are going to come after them. Now, at the very, very last moment, Burgoyne changes Baum's objective to the town of Bennington, because they had received reports that the quantities of supplies in Bennington were a lot more than that in Manchester. His reports were right. They were accurate. There was a better set of supplies in Bennington than there was in Manchester. However, his reports didn't tell him what else was in Bennington. Now, as the Continental Army had retreated from Fort Ticonderoga with the British Army advancing, there was a lot of alarm in Vermont and New Hampshire. And they distrusted the aristocratic New Yorker General Shuler, who, along with St. Clair, was at this time suspected of treachery in giving up Ticonderoga. So the New Hampshire Council decides to form a militia brigade to be commanded by Brigadier General John Stark. Stark, a veteran of the French and Indian War, the New Jersey Campaign, and our favorite friend from the Battle of Bunker Hill, was highly regarded in the region, and all the colonists in the area flocked to join his force. Stark's brigade that he had recently formed was in camp at Bennington. Traveling with him, Baum had a group of Native Americans, and as he advanced on Bennington, those Native Americans would kind of ravage and pillage the countryside around them. And they continued that until around August 14th, when Baum encountered an American scouting party at the Sancoc Mill. And that mill was about 8 miles west of Bennington. Baum advanced forward to the Wallamasack River outside of Bennington. And from there, Baum sent a dispatch to Burgoyne saying he intended to give battle to the Americans. And the dispatch that he sent actually reads as follows. August 14th, 1777, 9 o'clock. Sir, I have the honor to inform Your Excellency that I arrived here at 8 in the morning, having had intelligence of a party of our enemy being in possession of a mill which they abandoned at our approach, but, in their usual way, fired from the bushes and took to the road to Bennington. They left in the mill about 78 barrels of very fine flour, 1,000 bushels of wheat, 20 barrels of salt, and about 1,000 pounds worth of pearl and potashes. By 5 prisoners here, they agree that 1,500 to 1,800 men are in Bennington, but are supposed to leave it on our approach. I will proceed so far today as to fall on the enemy tomorrow early, and make such disposition as I think necessary from the intelligence I may receive. People are flocking in hourly and want to be armed. The savages cannot be controlled. They ruin and take everything they please. The American scouts from the mill headed back towards Bennington with news of Baum's approach. Far from retreating, as we know Stark would be, Stark immediately advanced to meet the English as they moved towards Bennington. Although Baum had little respect for the fighting ability of Stark's poorly trained and poorly equipped backwoodsmen, he realized he was outnumbered and sent for reinforcements. By the close of the day on August 14th, the American and British forces were at a standoff about 4 miles east of the mill. Stark's advantage of superior numbers was offset by Baum's strong position on high ground with professional troops supported by cannons and protected by earthen fortifications. The steamy summer heat came and produced heavy rains throughout the next day. And as we learned from Washington's winter campaign, wet gunpowder won't fire. Both armies decided to wait for the rain to stop, and they contemplated their strategies. Baum spent the day improving and expanding his position on what was called Hessian Hill. And it was called that because there was a group of Hessian soldiers primarily holding that hill. And he also posted a small force of loyalists on a lower hill across the river from his position. And that hill later became known as Tory Fort. At dawn, Burgoyne had sent about 500 German troops under Colonel Breyman to reinforce Baum. But the heavily burdened army made little progress over the rain-sodden roads, so there's too much mud for the troops to make it to Baum for backup. On the 16th of August, the weather cleared. Stark set in motion a rather elaborate plan to dislodge the British. And this is from Stark's personal diary and letters, this next account is. So this is written by Stark's hand himself. Here's what he said about his strategy for that day. I divided my army into 3 divisions and sent Colonel Nichols with 250 men on their rear of their left wing, Colonel Hendrick in the rear of their right with 300 men, ordered when joined to attack the same. In the meantime, I sent 300 men to oppose the enemy's front, to draw their attention that way. Soon after, I detached the Colonels Hubbard and Stickney on their right wing with 200 men to attack that part, all which plans had their desired effect. It probably sounds a lot fancier than it really is, but all Stark is really trying to do is encircle his enemy. So this strategy that he lays out pretty much makes like a C or a U around the British forces and surrounds them on at least 3 sides. And that's what his goal was. He was going to surround them, start laying fire on them, start charging into their ranks, and boom, that's what she wrote. At least that's what Stark thought anyway. And that's actually pretty much what happened. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the militias had surrounded the British positions and they started attacking from all sides. By 5 o'clock, the British were routed, and a German observer was with the detachment of Hessian troops on what was known as Hessian Hill. And here's what that German observer wrote about what he saw during that battle. He says, "Our dragoons fired at the enemy with cool deliberation and much courage, but it did not last long. They loaded their carbines behind the breastworks, but as soon as they raised up to aim their weapons, a bullet went through their heads. They fell backwards and no longer moved a finger. Thus, in a short time, our largest and best dragoons were sent to eternity." Now, once those Germans ran out of ammunition, the Germans that were left holding that hill, As soon as their ammo was gone, they were overrun, and all of their fleeing survivors were pursued all the way down the wooded backside of the hill, and they were either captured or killed. Baum himself was actually mortally wounded, and the Native Americans that were with Baum's group escaped early in the fighting, and they just slipped away to the west to rejoin Burgoyne's main force. Stark and his men also drove off the British forces that were on what was called Tory Hill, so it was the smaller hill that was across the river from their main position. And as those men attempted to escape across the river, a Continental Army colonel describes what happened to them. "The rebels pushed with a strong party on the front of the Loyalist where I commanded. As they were coming up, I observed a man fire at me, and I returned. He loaded again as he came up and discharged again at me, and crying out, 'Peters, you damn Tory, I have at you,' he rushed on me with his bayonet, which entered just below my left breast, but was turned by the bone. By this time, I was loaded, and I saw it was a rebel captain, an old schoolfellow and playmate, and a cousin of my wife's. Though his bayonet was in my body, I felt regret at being obliged to destroy him." To me, I think that's probably one of those powerful first-hand accounts that I've read over the course of this podcast so far. Just the fact that it's his friend that is stabbing him, and it's actually a cousin of his wife's, so through some indirect means, it's family. So that's a powerful piece there. "The colonial troops had suffered few losses overall, but they were dispersed pretty wide, and they were looting, they were guarding prisoners, and they were pursuing retreating survivors. So their cohesion has kind of broken down at this point. And at this point, Braman's reinforcements, which had been marching up the muddy road, and they were ignorant of bombs being turned and routed, they finally arrived, and Colonel Stark described the contest that saved his victory from reversal," because Stark was in a very, very precarious situation here with his troops all spread out. He could have easily been routed himself. Now, this is what Stark says. "Luckily for us, Colonel Warner's regiment of Green Mountain Rangers came up, which put a stop to their career. We soon rallied, and in a few minutes, the action became very warm and desperate, which lasted till night. We used their own cannon against them, which proved of great service to us. At sunset, we obliged them to retreat a second time. We pursued them till dark, when I was obliged to halt for fear of killing my own men." The end of the day of August 16th found the British foraging force virtually annihilated and Burgoyne in a more dangerous position than before. His army had lost approximately 10% of its men and was still short on supplies. The defeat at Bennington greatly discouraged Burgoyne's uneasy Native American allies. For the Patriots, it was a great psychological victory, bringing in hundreds of new militia enlistments. The total German and British losses at Bennington were recorded at 207 dead and 700 captured. American losses included 30 Americans dead and around 40 wounded. The battle was at times particularly brutal when Loyalists met Patriots, as in some cases they came from the same communities, as we saw in the account earlier. The prisoners who were first kept in Bennington were eventually marched to Boston for this very reason. Burgoyne's army was readying to cross the Hudson at Fort Edward on August 17th when the first word of the battle arrived. Believing that reinforcements might be necessary, Burgoyne marched the army towards Bennington until further word arrived that Braman and the remnants of his force were returning. Stragglers continued to arrive throughout the day and night, while word of the disaster spread within the camp. The overall effects of this battle on Burgoyne's campaign were incredibly significant. Not only had he lost nearly 1,000 men of his 8,000 total, half of those men were regulars, but he had also lost his crucial support of Native Americans. In a council following the battle, many of the Native Americans who had traveled all the way down from Quebec decided to go home, and this loss severely hampered Burgoyne's reconnaissance efforts in the days to come. The failure to bring in nearby supplies meant that he had to rely on supply lines that were already dangerously long, and that eventually broke in September the next month. The shortage of supplies was a significant factor in his decision to surrender at Saratoga, but we'll talk about that later. American patriots reacted to the news of the battle with optimism. especially after Burjoin's Native American screen left him, small groups of local patriots began to emerge to harass the fringes of British positions. Interestingly, a significant portion of Stark's forces returned home and did not again become influential in the campaign until they appeared at Saratoga on October 13th to complete the encirclement of Burgoyne's army. But that's something we'll talk about later. John Stark's reward from the New Hampshire General Assembly for, quote, the Memorial Battle of Bennington was a complete suit of clothes becoming his rank. A reward that Stark likely valued the highest was a message of thanks from John Hancock, President of the Continental Congress, which included a commission as Brigadier in the Army of the United States. Also in honor of this battle, we've seen the USS Bennington, which is an aircraft carrier that was commissioned for World War II, and later recommissioned for the Vietnam War, and interestingly enough, it was used as a recovery craft for the Apollo 4 spacecraft. Make sure to check out photos on the website to help you understand the material that we talked about here today. The website address is www.AmericanMilitaryHistoryPodcast.com. Check out the website, click on the link there, and you'll see all the images associated with this episode. All right, if you think that today's episode was worth a dollar or two, why not head over to the website and donate to support the podcast? Visit AmericanMilitaryHistoryPodcast.com and click on the green button that says Support the Podcast. On that page, you'll be able to give recurring donations with Patreon or single or recurring donations with PayPal. The podcast is listener-supported, and every little bit helps, even if you're just buying me a cup of coffee every month. I really enjoy coffee. In fact, I've got a cup right here. I'm going to take a drink. That's good coffee. That comes from you, my donors. Thanks for that. I'd like to thank the donors that donated for this week and for last week. In last week's episode, I think you guys remember I left a note. My family and I were at Disney, so I didn't get a chance to thank all of the donors that had donated since what would now be two episodes ago. I missed that, like I said, because I pre-recorded that episode. So here we go. I've got a longer list than normal today, but that's awesome that I have a long list. So here we go. Rock D with a recurring donation at the private first class level. Stephen M. donated at the sergeant level, but since he's an old Navy vet, we'll call it the chief petty officer level. And Stephen, don't worry, we're going to cover naval engagements in this podcast. Jason S. is recurring at the private first class level. Todd C. donated at the corporal level. And last but definitely not least, Wayne H. steps up as our first general level donor of 2016. That's a capital G on general. Wayne H. and Pam L. are the only two general level supporters that we currently have right now. So thanks to Wayne and all of my donors for the support that you give. It definitely helps keep the podcast running. And also all of my recurring donors, thank you for just honoring your monthly commitment month to month. Thanks for that. If you do donate to the podcast, you will get your name on the website, and you will also be mentioned on future episodes. To stay up to date with the podcast, you can follow the podcast on Facebook and Twitter, or there's an email newsletter as well. Links to all of those are on the website, or you can search Facebook and Twitter for American Military History. Now, thanks to all of my retweeters for the past 2 weeks. Here we go. It's got a longer list than normal, so here we go. At JimYat11, at Ritterton, at M. Lunyon, at McKeel88, at Jersey Vape Geek, at Abort76, at History Pod Fan, at Morpheus43, at DV Orlando, at Camel Law Truckin, at Do Not Matthews, and at HistoryCast. If you would like the illustrious honor of having your Twitter name mentioned here, just retweet one of my tweets to your followers. It's that simple. I'll read it out. I've gotten one more 5-star review on iTunes this week from Boston.Watchmaker. Thank you, Boston.Watchmaker. And thanks to all of you for reviewing the podcast. That brings us up to 47 total ratings. That is awesome. We are 3 away from our goal of 50. And I believe that iTunes is going to give you better placement the more reviews you have. I think that 50 is a milestone number for reviews. So I need 3 people right now, just go review it. You don't have to type anything fancy if you don't want to. Just go however many stars you think it's worth and save that review. However, if you do that, I don't know your name, so I can't thank you personally. If you type comments, I'm able to see that and I can thank you on the podcast. But let's see if we can get up to 50 and help this podcast grow. And speaking of growing, around the first of the year, the podcast jumped from around 500 to 600 downloads a day to around 750 to 850 downloads a day. That's actually really great. I mean, my personal goal that I've never shared with you guys is around 1,000 downloads a day. So we're getting really, really close to that. So that's great. Thank you guys for that. Let's see, what else do we have this week? A couple of personal news things here. So I already told you guys that I'm the father of three boys. Maybe I said three boys, but you guys know I'm a father. I have three boys, 8, 4, and 3. And I just found out a few weeks ago that I am going to be an uncle for the first time to a little boy. It is my wife's sister is having a baby, obviously, and it's a little boy, so I get to be the uncle. Now, it's actually pretty interesting kind of how the family kind of all works together and whatnot. My wife, her father, and obviously the father of the young lady that's going to have a little boy, it's the same father because they're sisters. He runs Space Rocket History Podcast. Some of you may listen to that. Some of you may not. His name is Mike Annis. He is www.spacerockethistory.com. And you can find him on iTunes by searching for Space Rocket History. He actually inspired me to do this podcast because he had already started. He's been going for 2 or 3 years now, I think. I'd have to look to see. And he does a similar type of podcast to what I do, where he kind of starts at the beginning of history and works all the way up to present day. But he does it with manned space travel. So if you're into that, it's actually really, really interesting. Go check it out. And, you know, go tell him that Justin from the American Military Podcast sent you over. And that would really help because, you know, anything that can help you get in better with the father-in-law is obviously a good thing. All right. There were no questions this week that I could answer on the podcast. If you would like to leave a voicemail with a question, you can call in at 704-360-0691. If you do that, I will play your question over the air or in the recording, however the right way is to say that, and we'll answer it. If you don't want to hear your voice on the podcast, just ask me a question on Twitter or Facebook or something like that. You know, I'd like to keep this end of the podcast section here open for you guys to kind of help drive the content of the podcast. So if you have questions or anything, feel free to ask and we'll dive into them a little bit deeper. Now, next week, we will be talking about one of the more famous battles of the Revolutionary War, the Battle of Brandywine. So until then, have a good day.